Let me read to you something from the UK Daily Mail, which is not a newspaper I usually read, but anyway, 2008, interesting article. It is said to have motivated Napoleon, spurred on Mussolini, driven Attila the Hun, and explained Stalin's maniacal lust for power. Now, scientists may finally have proof for the short man syndrome, the phenomenon where tiny men overcompensate for their lack of height through acts of aggression. A new scientific study has shown that shorter men are more likely to be jealous husbands and boyfriends than their taller counterparts. Controversy over short man syndrome, or the Napoleon complex, has raged for years. Supporters of the syndrome say that the society's obsession with height forces small men to overcompensate by becoming chippy, more aggressive, and in extreme cases, lust power. So look around you, right? Your next Colonel Gaddafi is in the room. And he's likely to be short. The new findings come from two studies carried out at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. Their researchers asked 100 men and 100 women how jealous they were in their current relationships. They were given a range of options from not jealous at all to morbidly jealous. Morbidly jealous. I'm so jealous. They were also asked how interested their partners were in members of the opposite sex. Shorter men were far more likely to say they were jealous than taller ones. Ooh. In a second study, 119 males and 230 female students were asked to say how jealous they would be if they were at a party and say their girlfriend or boyfriend flirted with a stranger. Again, taller men were the least jealous, short men the most. New Scientist reports today. By the way, if you're wondering why the women were involved in that, I didn't read out that bit, but apparently if you're a tall woman, you have the same problem as a short man. So you could be the next Napoleon. Nah. What is that article saying to us? I don't know. I'm not sure if you'd want to take it too seriously, but I think it's, you know, driving at something deep inside, which is all of us are looking for significance in some sort of way, aren't we? And the article's pointing out, look, maybe if you can't find significance in one area of life, you're going to overcompensate with another area of life. This is the whole Napoleon complex thing. I think about the word significance. Significance. Right? It's related to the word sign. All has to do with signs. And what do signs have to do with? It has to do with meaning. It has to do with identity. It has to do with value. So if you have no significance, then it's no sign, right? No meaning, no identity, no value. In a sense, no name. Right? We all need it. We all need significance. We all need meaning, identity, value. Now, different cultures will define what is significant differently. So for some cultures, height, right? For the Asian culture, it doesn't really matter. Yes. Okay, so that's the whole idea. We all need it. Now, we've got here in Luke 19 that we've just heard read out, we've got a man who you see is hungry for significance. Really hungry, desperate for significance. He meets Jesus, and what happens as a result is he's given the only kind of significance that really matters. And it's the kind that I'll argue will transcend culture, and it's the kind that will last forever. So firstly, let's just go back and have a look at this really interesting encounter. His name is Zacchaeus. I'll call him Zach, so it's easier that way. So you first meet him, and the funny thing is, if you've read other parts of the Bible, especially around, you know, the people that Jesus meet, you'll know that it's kind of unique how much we know about Zacchaeus, all right? Because we know more about him than almost every other person that meets Jesus. So we got there, sentence number two, have a look there. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. It's surprising that we know his name, all right? A lot of the people who meet Jesus in the accounts, you don't know his name. Now, one of the reasons perhaps that Luke, the writer, the historian, writes his name here is probably because he was well known by the time Luke wrote his account. That means he was probably a member of the early Christian movement. So you've got to actually see that already at the beginning. You've got a hint of the massive turnaround that this man's life is going to have from insignificant to significant. What are the other things we know about him? Well, we know his occupation, right? We know his occupation. It says that he's a chief tax collector. Now, this is not an insult on the accountants, all right? But tax collectors in the first centuries were about the lowest job you could have, especially in Jewish society. The reason was, you guys remember when after 2001, 10-year anniversary of September 11, and America sent troops immediately to fight right, in Afghanistan to oust the Taliban. They, within the first few months of fighting, they found an American fighting for the Taliban. Right? It's kind of like our David Hicks. Only for them, they were much more emotionally involved, yeah? Now, when you're an American fighting for the enemy, right, that's not a good position to be. Now, that's the kind of thing tax collectors were. They were collecting taxes on behalf of the occupiers, the Romans, from their own countrymen. And the other thing was, they almost had free rein to overcharge. So they would collect, they would extort, they would use violence, they would use Roman guards to help extort the money from their own people. And they were constantly in communication, in fellowship, in, you know, having meals, sitting down with, cavorting with what Jews considered to be Gentiles, which is non-Jews. So they were ceremonially, religiously unclean. I mean, it's a bit like this. Remember a few years ago, a convicted ex-pedophile. I don't know, he might still be a pedophile, but he was convicted for pedophilia. His name was Dennis Ferguson. I don't even remember reading. He was released on parole, and he wanted to move into an area. Right, I think it was around the riot area. And the whole neighborhood kicked up a stink. It's like, we don't want this man in our neighborhood. We don't want him to even live on the same street as us. Right? That level of disgust is the kind of thing that tax collectors got in Jewish society. He was not a popular man. He was socially outcast. Next, we find out that he was short. Okay, verse number 3, he was a short man. Now, it's not just a height thing, right? He's short, not just in terms of height, he's short in the eyes of his peers. That's really the significance. He is insignificant in the eyes of the people around him, in his society, being a tax collector. Another point of view, though, you might want to say that he is probably a classic Napoleon complex guy. You know, I read out that article about short people needing to overcompensate. Well, this guy probably did have that sort of thing going on. I mean, we find out that he was not just a tax collector, but he was a chief tax collector. Right, he wasn't just rich, he was wealthy. Right? He was actually very successful in his career. See, he must have worked really hard to climb that tax collector, you know, career ladder to compensate, I reckon, for his lacks in other ways. I mean, he was a short man. He probably felt neglected all his life. He wanted to compensate. He's saying, well, I'm not tall. I may not be, you know, the guy that the gals go for. I'm not the guy you'd look at and really look twice at, except maybe to laugh at. I'm not popular, but hey, you know what? I don't need to be, because I've found my niche. I've found my area of life where I can be successful. And sure, it's not going to win me friends, but I got money. See, that's Napoleon complex in operation. And I got to wonder if, maybe not to that extreme, but is that us in some sort of way? I mean, is that you? I can see it with me. Let me just ask you a question. When you feel unhappy about your life or circumstance, especially when you compare yourself to someone, when you feel unhappy about your life, how do you complete this sentence? Well, at least I... How do you complete that for you? When you feel unhappy, how do you complete that? Well, at least I... Is it, well, at least I have a good home? Well, at least I've got money? Well, at least I'm in a good uni degree? Well, at least I've got a future ahead of me? At least I've got a boyfriend? At least I've got a girlfriend? At least I go to church? At least I'm not as bad? How do you complete that sentence? How much security, in other words, do you place in that? You see, when you feel insignificant, what is that thing that you use to compensate? Because I think we all do that, don't we? We all take comfort in something that makes me feel like I'm someone, even if I can't compete with all the other things that other people have. It's a bit of Zacchaeus going on. All right, so Zacchaeus, he had, from one perspective, nothing. But from another perspective, he didn't care because he made up for it. He overcompensated. But even that level of significance that he had in his career, well, it wasn't enough. Look how desperate he was. Sentence number 3. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he couldn't because of the crowd. So he ran ahead. He climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Now, you know the difference between a fan and a groupie, yeah? I mean, fans will, you know, put posters up, buy all the music, you know, talk about the band. Groupies will go and buy every concert ticket that this band is performing in the country. So I have a friend like that when it came to Backstreet Boys. All right, she literally went from the Sydney concert, flew to the Melbourne concert, and went to the airport to try and meet them, you know, slept out overnight. That's the kind of thing. There's a lot of Apple groupies, you know, every time there's a new Apple product, they're like out on, you know, on George Street, lining up the night before. That's a groupie. That's different to a fan. Groupies are desperate, yeah? Desperate, desperate people. I know some of you probably cried this morning because the news was that Steve Jobs stepped down as CEO of Apple, right? That groupies are desperate. And this guy was desperate. He ran up ahead. He was a groupie, okay? He wasn't just content being part of the crowd. He knew that he couldn't see Jesus. He ran up ahead. By the way, running was very undignified for Jewish men, okay? Because they didn't wear pants. They kind of wore those, right? So you run, you suddenly wind blows, and it's a bit like Marilyn Monroe, okay? And imagine he's climbing a tree. Like, that's revealing more, isn't it? Okay, so that's what he did. It was very undignified. It was almost comical, but he was that desperate. He wanted so much to meet someone who might give him more. Now, people would have thought, what a loser. I mean, he was already kind of pretty low in their view. They would have just, you know, okay? I mean, that was probably what was going on. But you see, when you want Jesus more than any other, you're willing to be a fool to get him. And at this point, I guess it's worth saying that a lot of times in my experience of talking to people who are not yet Christians, and some of them are actually, you know, you might be pretty close. One of the obstacles that really often prevents people from coming to Jesus, even though they're intellectually satisfied with all the answers, is pride. Pride is often such a big obstacle. See, and religious people who think they're good, are often best at that. We want everything to be tame and containable and respectable. But here's the truth, friends. Sometimes Jesus will make you a little bit crazy. Right? Yeah, you're going to put on Pac-Man suits and walk around uni. No, you're going to laugh and cry and dance and sing, and you might be on your knees sometimes. You might give away your life. You might give up your uni, your career. Right? That's the kind of thing that happens. See, what's the problem of being a fool for Jesus if you understood, as the Bible says, Jesus made you, he loves you and he knows you. But we'll come to that in a moment. But this is what Zacchaeus is doing. Right? He comes to Jesus with abandonment. He makes a fool of himself. And what he's actually doing is he's saying, all those things I used to take security in, I used to feel comfortable about or take pride in, I'm willing to let it all go. My self-respect, whatever is left, let it all go in order to gain something more. And I want to say to you today, if you are searching for meaning in your life, especially in relation to Jesus, you got to do that, not in exactly that way, but you got to do that to in some way in your life. In a sense, God has got to break you before he can remake you. Right? Don't let pride be what stops you from coming to Jesus. So he's desperate for more, but the next point, number three, he comes face to face with Jesus, face to face with more. And what happens is Jesus gives Zacchaeus a new significance. Now, how does he do that? Firstly, he gives him a name. Well, he calls him by name. Look at verse 5. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So Zacchaeus came down at once and welcomed him gladly. You notice who took the initiative, all right? I mean, Jesus, with the crowd around him, he could have just walked straight past. There wouldn't have been nothing Zacchaeus would have been able to do. He could have cried out. He could have called out, Jesus, don't forget me. But people would just tell him to shut up, all right? But no, what happens was this. Jesus walks up to him. Jesus walks up to him, and here's the thing, Jesus knew his name. How did Jesus know his name? Maybe, probably, even, that he was just very well known. He was such a dirtbag that everyone knew him, and Jesus knew him before coming into that. But I think there's a hint that there's something more than that. Remember, your name is your significance. Jesus knew his name and called his name out, not just as someone who might have heard about him, but I think deeper than that, remember, Jesus is God come to earth as a man. God the Creator knew his creature. And as God comes to his creation, this man who other people considered insignificant, Jesus says, others might not notice you. Others might not want to know you. Others would be ashamed to say your name, but you know what? I'm not. Calling him by name was to say, I accept you. With all your brokenness, just as you are, with all your insignificance, I've come for you. Right? Jesus does that, but then next he invites himself over to Zacchaeus' house. He invites himself over. That's like the biggest honor possible. I mean, Jesus himself was homeless. He couldn't invite Zacchaeus over to his home. But imagine someone really significant inviting themselves over to your house. If you've got any MasterChef fans in this room, I'm really hoping. Otherwise, this illustration will tank. But if you liked MasterChef, you'll know that one of the end challenges was George and Gary, right? These kind of famous chefs. After a challenge, they went to cook at one of the contestants' house, Alana, who won the challenge. All right? I mean, that would be a huge honor if you're a bit of a foodie, a bit of a MasterChef fan. I mean, these MasterChefs and these judges are coming over to my house. I mean, I'd be freaking out because our kitchen is dirty, small, tiny, disgusting. Alana's house seemed to be much nicer. But anyway, that is almost the greatest honor someone can bestow on you. I'm coming over to your house. All right? Now, you can substitute George and Gary with someone you like. All right? I'm coming to your house. Now, in the case of MasterChef, it was a challenge and Alana won it. In the case of Zacchaeus, he didn't win anything. He didn't earn it. Okay? He didn't do anything for Jesus to say, I want to bestow on you this honor. Remember that there and then, Zacchaeus probably had no friends. And here's Jesus walking up to him, picking him out of the crowd, and saying, I want to be your friend. I want to eat at your house. You see, you might be here and you might not have been the smart one or the popular one or the tall one or the beautiful one or the favorite one or the outstanding one or the special one. You know what? God, your creator, thinks the world of you. Jesus knows you by name. If you have his friendship, suddenly, others don't matter that much anymore. That's what happens with Zacchaeus. Jesus gives him a new significance. And look at the reaction. Well, firstly, the reaction of the people. Sentence number 7. All the people saw this and began to mutter, he has gone to be the guest of a sinner. Understandable from one point of view. Again, if this was, you know, David Hicks, Dennis Ferguson, the pedophile, we would be going, what, Jesus, you, God, come into your house to befriend you? But from another point of view, it's exactly the thing that keeps the Savior at bay. Jesus has come, we'll find out in a moment how he saves us, but he's come to save. And if you don't think you need saving, when you actually do, but when you don't think you need saving, you keep him at bay, just like, well, one year I went out and I was caught in a rip at the beach and I was dragged out. I really couldn't save myself. I'm not a very strong swimmer anyway, but put on my hands. The lifeguard came. You know, the first thing the lifeguard said is, don't struggle. Just put yourself on my board. And I did that. But imagine if I did struggle. Imagine if I at that point said, no, I'm going to keep trying my best. You know, give me your surfboard. I'll swim. Right? That's going to be a problem, right? Because he can't save someone who doesn't think they need to be saved, even though they do. And here's the thing. People there, the religious folk, and you might be one of those. You might be a church person all your life. You might be, or not a church person, you think you're pretty good. You're a moral person, right? No better way of keeping the Savior at bay than thinking that you don't need to be saved. And you spend all your time looking at people like Zacchaeus and thinking, I'll never be like him. I'm much better than him. You know the kind of people Jesus did hang around with? Were people like tax collectors, prostitutes, the scum, the people who ended up putting Jesus on the cross, from a human point of view, were the religious and the moral. All right, so that's the reaction of the crowd. But then look at the reaction of Zacchaeus, who found this new significance. Sentence number 8. Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back 4 times the amount. Now, you notice there, Zacchaeus stood up. Not a minor detail there. He stood up. He is now standing tall. See, no matter how the world regards you, if Jesus regards you, you're 10 foot tall. Okay? He's got this new significance. Interesting, Zacchaeus at that point, he says to the Lord. Remember, it's people around him muttering, how could you do this? Now, Zacchaeus at that point would have, like us, probably should have defended himself to the people around. He didn't do that. He speaks to Jesus. He says to the Lord, right? Because at this point, what he's about to do isn't about pleasing them anymore. Isn't about being significant in their eyes anymore. He's already got the only significance that matters, and it's changed him. So he's speaking to the one who gave him that significance. And you see what a radical change that is. When he says, if I've cheated anybody, that's not a rhetorical statement. Right? The assumption is that he has cheated lots of people. And he's going to give back four times the amount. He wasn't going to be a rich man after that. But he wouldn't need to. Money serves different purposes for different people. For some, it's a means of gaining power. For others, it's a means of pursuing pleasure. For Zacchaeus, it was a means of gaining approval and significance. Well, he wouldn't need money anymore, would he? He's got his significance. And so Jesus makes the pronouncement, sentence 9. Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. What this is saying is this. Jesus doesn't just give him temporary significance. He gives him now an eternal significance. Salvation has come in the fullest sense, right? You're right with God for all eternity. A son of Abraham there is a way of saying you have full membership into God's chosen, special, beloved people. If you want to be significant, you're part of that significant people. And so you see what Jesus does. First, he says Zacchaeus. He calls him by his name. And that's how Jesus starts with all of us. He's going to call you by your name. That is, I accept you as you are. Broken, insignificant, hurt, guilty. However you come to me, I accept you. But I'm also going to give you another name. A significant, eternal one. Son of Abraham. I'm going to make you someone new. When Jesus gives you significance, he doesn't just take care of the now, he takes care of all eternity. Do you want more? More significance? See, I think we all have a choice here, don't we? And we can continue to let our significance come from the opinions of everyone else, or let it come from the only person it matters, your Creator, God, Jesus. Now, at this point, some of you are thinking, come on. My significance doesn't, I'm not a slave to peer pressure. My significance comes from me. And I guess I just want to gently push back on that and say, really? Really? I mean, it's a bit naive, don't you think, to think that we aren't products of our environment? See, whatever it is that we value, it is shaped by those around us. Whether it's culture or family or peers, yeah, we are. Why do you wear what you wear? Remember the movie Devil Wears Prada? Yeah? And there's that bit where Anne Hathaway's character, who's, you know, all this fashion stuff is a joke, and she's like snickering while they, you know, putting on these clothes. And Miranda, who's the boss, comes up to her and says, you think you made the choices for the daggy clothes that you're wearing today, but let me tell you how it came about. Do you remember that scene? You know, 3 years ago, this designer put that, you know, and that color, that exact color, right? You're wearing it, right? Even though you bought it from Kmart, because it made the fashion 3 years ago in Paris. Do you see how the choices we make have been dictated by the people around us? And so you think, I define my success, I define my looks, I define my significance. And these are the reasons why I feel significant. And I want to just push back and say, really? Really? Are you really living for your own significance? Or are you like all of us, our significance has to come from outside of ourselves? See, the question isn't, do I want Jesus to be my significance or me to be my significance? The question is, do I want Jesus, the one who made me, loves me, and knows me, to be my significance or someone else? Because letting others define us, if you've ever really been in that situation, it's pretty tiring stuff, isn't it? Isn't it tiring living up to other people's standards all the time? Making sure that our identity comes from their approval. It's insecure and it's tiring. Jesus today is offering you more. Two ways he does. Firstly, what he offers you is more because it's not based on your performance. It's not based on your performance. The summary of Jesus' mission is sentence number 10. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. Right? The whole point of Jesus' mission is to give you a significance not based on performance. Lost people can't find themselves. Drowning people can't save themselves. You need to be found. You need to be saved. That's what Jesus has come to do. In Luke 19, this bit, the first sentence there, Jesus was passing through Jericho. Where was he going? as he was passing through Jericho. These are the end chapters of Luke's account. I'll tell you where Jesus was going. He was going to Jerusalem. Why was he going to Jerusalem? He was going deliberately to die. Jesus' mission was only complete when he dies on the cross a few chapters later. And the reason he dies is he wants to trade with us. Okay, God's justice demands that the wrongs be set right. That includes my wrongs, your wrongs, my sin, your sin, my guilt, your guilt. God's love meant that he was on a mission to trade with us so that he, Jesus, would be punished instead of us. So let's put it in the words I've been using. Jesus takes on your insignificance and my insignificance, especially in the eyes of God. That's what sin does. And he gives us his significance. His internal, God-pleasing, perfect, beautiful significance. It's a free trade. See, Jesus came to seek the lost, but in order to find us, he became lost. Relationally lost. On the cross, Jesus, we read, cried out, God, why have you abandoned me? Because at that point, he took on our lostness so that he could save the lost. In another part of the Bible, it says that Jesus himself bore our sins on his body on the tree. The tree is a word for way of talking about the cross. By his wounds, you've been healed. Really interesting, isn't it, when you think about the tree? Zacchaeus didn't know that day that for him to come down from the tree, Jesus had to go up another tree. But that's what he did. And he does it because your significance is not going to come from your performance or mine. It frees you. It's going to come from Jesus' perfect performance. Next, his significance is something you cannot lose. It's funny, like some of us, you might be feeling very secure because the people that make you feel significant, the jobs or the careers or the identity you take pride in, you really feel like, yeah, I'm happy with that. But let me tell you, it will fade. It'll go. Your looks, your wealth, your pleasure, your career, your approval from others, it goes. Your work, your relationships, your achievement, it doesn't last. So let me ask you, what happens when you lose it? Retirees really feel this, especially in the sporting realm. Right? So many sports people, because they retire early, don't they? Because they can't keep going. But the age of 30, they stop playing whatever sport it is. And you just feel the sense of lostness. They're wealthy beyond measure, but they're so lost. Because their identity is tied up with that. And now they're not doing that. They don't know who they are anymore. But not so with Jesus. Jesus rose from the dead. He continues to call people. Today, I suspect he's calling some of you here by name. And when he gives you significance, it's eternal. And nothing can ever take that away from you. Is he calling you today? Now, if he is, and you really feel that he is, then what you need to do is to actually let him come to your home. Not literally, but into your life. He's calling you. He's inviting himself over. What I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest a simple prayer that if you're ready to, you can just pray along with me later on when I pray it. Have a read of it. It's just on the outline. It just says the kind of things you'll need to say to Jesus. If you're today, you're really convicted that he wants in and you want him to give you more significance. Have a quick read in just in your own head. And if these are words that you really think, yeah, I can pray that, and I can pray that and mean that, then I'm going to pray it and pause between each sentence, and you can just echo it quietly in your heads to Jesus. If you're not ready to pray something like this, then there are a few things you could do. You could pray something that's appropriate in your circumstance, right? But for those who are ready to pray, I'll just offer it to you now, and why don't you do that with me? It's a bold move, it's a brave move, but hopefully, like Zacchaeus, you'll see that this is what you've been looking for all that time. He's just been calling you, and now you're finally ready to respond. So if everyone can just kind of look down so you're not looking around you, I'll pray this, and those who want to pray it with me can do it quietly in their heads. Dear Jesus, I'm sorry that I've been looking everywhere else for significance. I'm sorry that this has sidelined you, my rightful creator. Please forgive me. Thank you that you died for my forgiveness and significance. I invite you to come into my life. I want to change and follow you from now on. Amen. If that's something that you've done and that's been a meaningful first time, then that's great news. Jesus has entered into your life and he's given you more significance that really the rest of your life now is just to discover how great that is. And we want to help you do that, especially the students and the staff here at and the staff workers here at Credo. Jess is going to come and explain that, how that's going to happen in a moment. But I think we're also going to hear from Kirby, right? As she tells us a little bit about how she found significance in Jesus.